I'm Justin Katz, recording Last Impressions 47 on March 30th, 2018, to talk about how society confuses kettle, the benefits of religion, and what does collusion mean anyway? As you may have noticed, it's been a couple weeks since I've recorded one of these podcasts. I'm not quite sure where the time goes. It just seems everything piles together, and before you know it, there's no time to sit around a microphone and talk. What? One thing I did do, though, and I want to mention right up front here, I set up on OceanStateCurrent.com a page. You can find it right at the top. There's a link at the top of every page. And the page is called Subscribe, Friend, and Follow. And I'm trying in a more determined way to make sure that everybody who's interested in our content on Ocean State Current, or my content, if you're that dedicated, can make sure we can reach you wherever you want to be reached. So visit that page. You can find the Facebook links, Twitter links, iTunes, YouTube. We're just trying to build that up. Oh, and the newsletter, the mailing list with your email, that'd be helpful too. We got to get something building here, because it seems like people who think in a common sense, conservative way are kind of being edged out of a lot of the venues where people share and collect information. And we need to come up with a response to that trend. And that's one of the best ways you can do that is help us to find ways to remind you that we're here, and ways for you to share our content. And also let us know, very important, you can email me at jkatz@oceanstatecurrent.com. If there are any social media type things or any ways that you get your information that aren't listed there, let us know about that. It's probably somewhere we'll want to be. And in all of these ways, keep your eye out. We'll be putting out surveys, trying to understand better what everybody wants to see, where they get their info, and that kind of thing. So on with business. This week, not this week, sorry, since the last podcast, Tim White and Ted Nesi on WPRI did some digging into documents that had been released with details about the investigation of former Republican state senator Nicholas Kettle, who, you probably don't need reminding, was arrested and charged for a couple of not single instances, but a couple of variations of sexual misbehavior. He was threatened with expulsion from the Senate and decided to resign rather than face that down. And, you know, reading the details as they've been released, my thought is, you know, wow, our society is dysfunctional. So there are two basic charges here. One, the one that's arguably more serious, I mean, it's the one that had the Senate moving to kick Kettle out of their ranks, is that he had some sort of a sexual relationship with a male page who was younger than he is or was when the relationship was going on. Often we don't get the relative ages. We're only talking a 2-3 years difference. But at a certain age, at a certain time in your life, that's the difference between boy and man, or at least young man. So that can be significant. So that's one charge. And the other charge is the video voyeurism where he filmed his then girlfriend or took pictures of her in some compromising ways and shared those pictures with a friend of his who was doing the same with his wife. Now, on the more serious charge, which is arguably more serious charge, the relationship with the page. Page, if you don't know, is they're sort of like interns or young helpers in a General Assembly. And from the little bit that WPRI has reported, it sounds like this relationship between Kettle and the young man, the kid, sounds like that relationship started before Kettle took office. And so that would have made Kettle 16 or 17. The other kid was, I've seen different numbers, 12 to 14, somewhere in there. Now, I want to be very clear here. I am not condoning what Kettle did. Depending how big the age difference really was, I mean, if he was 17 and the kid was 12, that's pretty big deal. If it was closer, well, not so much. Again, I'm not condoning what Kettle did, but you know, I can't help but feel like our society's prosecutorial zeal, for lack of a better term, is forcing us to live in this stressful world in which we just can't know the rules. It's like this tantalizing freedom, libertine freedom, not true, you know, in the American Bill of Rights sense, but like tantalizing do whatever you want kind of freedom is dangled in front of us. And then the rules can completely change depending who we are, who with whom we run and we have contact. I'm thinking of back in the 1980s when I would have been right in that gray area of when Kettle's relationship started and the other kid was younger, somewhere in there back in the 80s. Back when the elites who made movies, they were still trying to be somewhat subtle about their promotion of homosexuality. It was much more of a, much less overt, much more of a, hey, don't hurt people kind of a vibe. And there was a subgenre, a whole subgenre of these after school special kind of movies that they would show when kids were home after, perhaps before mom and dad got home from work, after school, they weren't ready to start their homework. And there were these kind of almost instructional morality tales in form of movies and TV shows. I think one series was actually called After School Specials. But there was a subgenre of these about school-aged boys or young men coming out as gay. One with Scott Baio, maybe the most famous, was The Truth About Alex. Another one, Welcome Home, Bobby. The stars, mind you, were not the bigger name stars in these movies tended not to be the gay character. But Welcome Home, Bobby was another one that had, I'm forgetting his name. He's a recognizable face that you'll know if you watch movies at all. And then there was another one that the internet didn't manage to help me remember. But one of the key messages of these movies was that it's absolutely normal for boys to experiment sexually with each other. Absolutely normal. This was a big theme that arose in all of these movies. And the message, at least as I took it then and reflecting back on it now, the message was, well, you know what? Don't get all weird and insecure and aggressive or anything like that when a friend that you've been experimenting with comes out as gay. Don't get insecure. It's normal. So that was the message. What these movies didn't tell us, apparently, was that this very experimentation could eventually sweep you up in a moral panic about sexual harassment if you're not careful. And I think the concept of the moral panic in this instance in particular is very important to pause on. So I don't think you can have any doubt that our society is highly sexualized at this point. Sex is in everything. And people are, separately from that, people are being defined entirely by their sexuality. You've got the LGBT plus or dot, 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 or et cetera. The people you want to have intimate relationships with, that defines your identity group in a lot of ways, or it's one key aspect of that. On top of that, a lot of the message is, hey, anything goes, unless, you know, you're Republican or something, and then you have to live by a very different standard. But there's this kind of everything goes, men and women, porn, this, that, the other thing. Those rules are all gone. And yet, the rules can change in an instant. If you're, as I just suggested, if you're the wrong kind of person, or if you're politically disfavored, or if you run into the wrong person. I mean, the message in a nutshell is kind of like, just be true to you, unless we decide that we don't like you and then we'll take you out. I mean, that's basically the message that's out there now. And, you know, it's no wonder young men are so screwed up in that environment. It's just you can't know what rules you're trying to play by. You can't deal with them. You don't know how to position yourself emotionally. You don't know how to structure your relationships. Nobody can teach you how, in fact, because we don't know. Hey, when I was a kid, that was considered something all boys do, and now you're being pilloried for it, as if it's some sort of horrible deviance that ought to have you locked up in jail. Now, again, I don't know the details of Kettle's specific situation, so there may have been lines crossed there. I'm just speaking generally here. And as for the voyeurism charge, well, you know, that's a perversion I have to confess I just don't get. I don't understand the objectification of somebody you supposedly care about, and the violation of their trust. I mean, I've been calling the other one more serious because that's gotten a lot more of the attacks on Kettle have been much more pronounced in that area, but the voyeurism thing is just not right. And in both cases, I think you have to say, if the accusations are true and they haven't been proven in a legal sense, and certainly I don't have the details to say one way or another, definitively what lines were crossed. If they're true, though, you know, Nick Kettle has and should continue to pay a personal price for his behavior. I mean, being young doesn't save you from that, but. And, well, hopefully the price will serve the purpose of leading him to fix whatever is kind of broken in his psychology. Again, if the accusations are true. But the important point here I'm trying to get to is that I think we have to acknowledge our culture's role in breaking that psychology of young men. And we're setting them up for failure. And it's not only on the sexual thing. I mean, if you look at, I wrote a post and I've had an op-ed in the Cranston Herald recently and maybe elsewhere, talking about how we're not teaching boys how to grow up and address their feelings and their reactions to the world in a sort of masculine way, which I would say is sort of taking your frustrations and putting them into some kind of an action. And it can be a very subtle thing to learn. And we're thwarting that too. So at the same time, you know, natural hormones and sexual urges of men are becoming very challenging on a slippery surface of political correctness and changing ideologies. Not only that, but a lot of the ways boys learn to channel those feelings, say going into medicine or science or something like that, a lot of those ways are being suppressed because the thing of the moment is to promote girls, especially in those kind of historically male dominated fields. And so you get the governor of the state of Rhode Island holding a contest for school children that only girls can join in on. I mean, no wonder we're having these problems. And it seems to me that this breakage, this confusion, should create a real opportunity for religious organizations. This occurred to me listening to podcast featuring David French and Alexandra De Sanctis of National Review. It was at the time of this clip called the Liberty Files podcast. Now I think it's Ordered Liberty. But David, here's David French talking about the value of that people invest in religious communities.
Faithful religious communities, particularly faithful religious communities of the Orthodox within the mainstream of the Orthodox tradition, as opposed to some, you know, extremist sect, tend to be pretty high functioning, community oriented, warm, friendly places that you want to belong to. I mean, our church is a tremendous community here in our little town in Tennessee. And so there, especially in a culture where people are often feeling disconnected, when you're looking at schools, where schools often seem, you know, not just indifferent to your values, but sometimes even hostile to your values, or they have environments that are rife with bullying or other kinds of misconduct, you can look at a Christian community, a faithful Catholic community, a faithful Protestant community, and say, I want to be a part of that.
Now, French, the context in which he's talking here is the need of religious communities to recognize that people who are involved with them might not share all of their theological values. You see this at Catholic schools where, it's whether because it's just a good school and parents want the educational aspect, or they kind of like the uniforms and the whole kind of structure of a Catholic school, will send their children there without actually being Catholic. They just want to be part of something, and they think the moral foundation is good. I think of when the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity was advocating for school choice more strongly than, I mean, it's an ongoing thing, but when that was a dedicated project a few years ago, a woman came from one of the Catholic schools over there on the mainland over there in that other part of the country in central Rhode Island. This woman came, I think she was a single mom, Native American, and she talked about how she was raised in a very rough situation with sexual abuse and all this, and how it was very important to her that her daughter have access to this moral foundation. I've seen with other children at my children's schools, people who aren't religious, but they think it's just a healthy environment. And that's an opportunity for those of us who are religious to draw people toward us. And we draw them toward us. The moral foundation's a big part of that, improving their worldviews and stuff. But as people are ready to look more deeply into it, they look, okay, what is providing this foundation? And that's important. And you can't really pursue that mission if you've got overly strict rules of entry. And I think that was part of what French was talking about. Of course, at the same time, there have to be some rules of entry, right? There have to be some standards and some respect for what the beliefs of the community actually are. Otherwise, the community loses what's really important about it and what defines it and what gives it the foundation I was talking about. So one of the key rules of conduct should probably be respecting the foundational values of the religion. I actually had keyed this clip to talk about prior to the big story at a Providence College, in which a student, Michael Smolenskis, who was a resident assistant at Providence College, is Catholic. And he had, in response to, for a whole month, there had been a bulletin board in an all-girls freshman, sophomore, I think, dormitory promoting same-sex marriage and with an emphasis on lesbianism, which right then, you know, makes you shake your head. This is a Catholic school with dormitories divided by sex, presumably so that the sexes don't do what people of different sexes tend to do. And so they can be formed fully in their own self, their own gender, their own sex. And here there's advertisements for lesbianism. It's just something, apparently that was uncontroversial. And to me, that's stunning. So Michael put up a bulletin board in his own all male dormitory, just nicely presenting the Catholic understanding of marriage. And it was torn down. He was actually moved out of his dorm for a night for his own safety. And the reaction was kind of almost hostile from the administration at first. You know, that you have the more extreme folks in the administration who maybe oversee the RAs, and they're much more, he was being homophobic, they're much more, that's their attitude, is they're much more in line with the current hip trends of our culture, and promoting the LGBT, etc. Ideology. And then you had you have some religious figures mainly staying in the background. We ran a letter from a bunch of theology, philosophy professors, and a few from some other disciplines supporting him, saying this is Catholic belief, folks, you know. And then the president of the Reverend Shanley kind of really tried to stay in the middle. Now I don't want to go into this too much. We've done a whole lot of it on The Current. You can find it there. And I've got some bigger picture stuff I want to let my brain wrap around for a while. But the point is, there's a mission of Catholic or other religious institutions, and there's a benefit, there's a strength and a foundation that they can provide. And I think as our society has kind of lost, I've said before, we're running on the fumes of our heritage. We people still believe in the morality, but, you know, very, very self-aware people will, when they identify a belief in themselves, will work that down to its foundations to understand why they believe it. Society-wide, it doesn't really work like that. People just learn what's true and good, and over time, if there's a foundation, it will flourish. If there's a reason for it, because then anybody who does think about it or look into it some more or try to develop it reaffirms the belief. If there's no foundation, then it will be challenged and deteriorate, because there's always somebody who's going to say, well, why not? Why can't I do what I want to do? Your explanation isn't satisfying to me, and there's no foundation for it. And over time, the things that people want to be able to do that builds up and snowballs. And so you need that foundation. And that's a lot like the stability. I'm not sure which angle I'm coming at this from. On one hand, there's the stability helps us to be happier and more moral and more moral, slurring. And on the other hand, that's all deteriorating, and we need to build that back up. We need foundations. We need families with fathers who can teach their sons subtly to be masculine without being toxic. And you can't see the air quotes, obviously, but I'm doing them. You need a religious foundation to give something that supports that moral vision that people know is needed, and that people that attracts people. And we see with mainstream religions and other organizations that try to discard that foundation and say, we don't really need the trappings. We need the substance. You know, the substance doesn't lack without the foundation. You ever try to eat a kind of drippy roast beef sandwich without a good piece of bread that'll hold it? It doesn't work very well. which, in a kind of contradictory way, I guess, As you can tell, I don't have the "and so" for this conversation. I'm kind of, these are basically, I'm looking at three topics that all have kind of come together coincidentally in different things I've seen or listened to. And I'm trying to pull them all into one. But this feels somehow related to the whole Trump-Russia collusion thing and President Trump in general as a Republican. A lot of conservatives still have a problem with President Trump, and depending how you define it, I'm one of them. I mean, I don't like his presentation. I never have. I've never bought the genius businessman image, and the coarseness bugs me, and I think in the long run, you are who you say you are. On the other hand, being moral isn't a surrender. We do, somewhere there's a line where we have to act in this world, right? We can't, we're not, I don't think we're all called to be monks and nuns who will just peacefully go about their business until waiting potentially to be slaughtered. I mean, now surviving slaughter is not the highest good. The highest good, in my view, is the relationship with God, which can happen in suffering, especially. So in some ways, we shouldn't shy from those sorts of things. But I don't think we're all called to sit there and wait and let it wash over us. Otherwise we wouldn't be called to help other people, right? Because then you're interfering with their suffering. So somewhere there's a line here where, you know, you work with the politician who helps to make the world better, and you can't just put a because of the policies, not because of the personality. And you can't just say, you know what, he's off-putting. I don't like the way he's doing this. The method is terrible, and so we can't cooperate with this. Some conservatives, though, are like that, and they simply can't accept his being in our fold. I disagree with that in some, you know, in large part because, you know, you're never going to have a significant number of pure warriors, and your enemies are always going to want to highlight the things that your warrior should, that where your warriors contradict your values. We see that. That's why Republicans are always held to a higher standard for behavior, because their enemies control the narrative. But there's also sort of in the spirit of colleges accepting, Catholic colleges or other religious colleges accepting the people who don't share their morality in the hopes of drawing them toward them. We have to keep that in mind with people like President Trump, that we're supposed to want to draw people whose behavior is objectionable to a better way. So there are a lot of similarities there. But, you know, you can't dismiss the gut aversion to President Trump. I was thinking of this in particular with Jonah Goldberg, who is a National Review columnist, and he now has a podcast called The Remnant. And he had an episode recently in which he was talking to Andrew McCarthy, also of National Review, who was a prosecutor in government, helped to prosecute the blind sheik who tried to blow up the World Trade Center the first time. And Andrew McCarthy's been writing really great stuff with his inside expert perspective about the investigation, the Mueller investigation, and so on into President Trump with this whole collusion narrative. And what made this conversation very interesting is Goldberg is very much dislikes President Trump, is inclined to think the worst of him and leave open possibilities that he's done badly. But this clip, something caught my ear in this, and I thought it was interesting enough to share.
To the extent I'm willing to say that I think Donald Trump colluded with Russia is that he gave a speech in public where he said, hey, Russia, get her emails, right? And to me, that's a smoking gun. Now, whether you think that was terrible or not, reasonable people can disagree. I don't think he meant that he was joking when he says he was joking. But it's one of these things where everyone is sort of searching for this thing that will – let them off the hook about having to actually make their own judgments.
So that's actually a relatively mild version of something I've heard Goldberg say before, that's the smoking gun. Was that saying, hey, Russia, go get the tape. I hope Russia releases the tapes. Even if the president and the candidate wasn't joking and was absolutely serious, saying, I call for Russia to find the tapes and release them. Even if he was completely serious, though, it bothers me that Goldberg takes this position, because that's not collusion. Collusion is working together. It's give and take. It's cooperation. Collusion would require Donald Trump to have given Russia something to help it along in its reactions. It's not just saying, hey, if you can do that, go do it. More power to you. He had nothing of value to give to Russia and made no promises. It was just a statement. Now, if those things exist, that's what's implied here. And we don't have any evidence that Trump said behind the scenes, this is what I will give you in exchange, or he actually sent something to help that along. I mean, it was just, there's no evidence of that. That would be the smoking gun. And so far, with all of the leaks and all of the months and months and months of investigation, there's been nothing. So, and Goldberg must get this. I mean, he's smart enough. he must understand what collusion is, but there's something that Trump violates that, or there's something in Trump's that something in Trump that violates Goldberg's foundational values, and frankly, they're values that I share for the most part. But what Jonah wants to do is find some way to keep Trump at arm's length, even as he turns out to do things that so far conservatives are pretty happy with. And again, none of this is easy. Where are the lines? Where are they? Between pragmatism and principle and openness, you know, between standing up for people when, you know, they're just following the mores of their time, and then the time changes and everybody wants to go persecute them. Yet, I mean, you know, you don't want to support what they did, but at the same time, you want to support the principle that there ought to be rules, that they were told that this was, you know, normal, and then suddenly we're attacking them for it. This is not easy. And, you know, honestly, on this Good Friday, which is what today is as I record this, I'm kind of glad it's not easy. Folk singer I enjoy quite a bit, David Wilcox, has a song. I think it's called An Apple a Day. And the point of it is, we don't really want Eden, at least not in this life. You want the challenges. You want things to not be easy. And that's kind of the point. I think it's like my kids when they take a test in certain subjects and they get credit if they show their work and they were on the right track, because it's the work. It's working through the problems. That's the key thing. That's a key lesson. And so I guess it's okay that this isn't easy, but we have to keep at it. And I think the way we do that is pushing back on what we're supposed to think and holding to rules, even when it causes us to consort with people and in some respects support people whom we don't necessarily support, while also while also being conscious of having to improve the world and having to compromise sometimes in that regard. And the good thing, the advice I would offer is, you know, don't worry too much about your first impressions, because you can always fix them. It's your last impressions. Those can last an eternity.